I'm Andrew Schwartz, and you're listening to The Truth of the Matter, a podcast by CSIS where we break down the top policy issues of the day and talk with the people that can help us best understand what's really going on. To get to the truth of the matter about domestic extremism in the United States, we have with us CNN's longtime national security analyst, Peter Bergen, who's widely known for landing the first televised interview with Osama bin Laden in 1997, and with William Pierce, a key leader of the American neo-Nazi movement and Turner Diaries author. Peter is really one of the most renowned experts on terrorism in the world. I've been following his work for a very long time. But I really wanted to start, Peter, with a recent episode of your weekly national security podcast, In the Room with Peter Bergen, which aired in mid-February. You went in depth on extremism in America and why it's America's biggest terror threat domestically. Why has there been such a rise in domestic terrorism in the United States?
That's a great question. And I wish there was a simple answer. I mean, I think what is... You know, New America, the research institution I work at, we track lethal terrorist attacks since 9/11. And I'll just give you the numbers. And, you know, lethal terrorist attacks are not an exact proxy for the scale of the threat, but I think they're a reasonable proxy for the scale of the threat. In terms of right-wing terrorists, murders by right-wing terrorists, there are more than 130 since 9/11. There have been 107 by jihadi terrorists since 9/11. There have been 17 by, we started this new category, so-called incel, you know, people who murder women for ideological reasons, because they're misogynists, not just because they're killing somebody, they're doing it for a political purpose.
Those people are called incels, correct?
They are called incels. 12 for black nationalists, black separatists, and one for far-left terrorists. So that kind of really gives you a sense of who is carrying out lethal terrorist attacks. And then we use a pretty conservative methodology. When somebody is killed, usually there is a lot of press coverage, a lot of it accurate press coverage, and of course there's also court documents. And so we can say with some degree of certainty that the person who carried this act out wasn't insane or wasn't acting just out of normal run-of-the-mill pathologies or whatever, but they did it for political purposes. So, and if you look at the graph of the domestic far-right extremist, you know, it's been very consistent since 9/11. It's sort of gone up. The jihadi terrorists have sort of receded. There was a big spike when ISIS was having its caliphate in Iraq and Syria in the 2014 to 2015, 2016 time period. You know, we had big terrorist attacks in the United States inspired by ISIS. So for instance, the Orlando attack at the nightclub, which killed 49 people by Omar Mateen. So ISIS's geographical caliphate kind of inspired a lot of attacks, and ISIS was trying to inspire attacks. But since then, I mentioned Pensacola. There was an attack in Pensacola in 2019. A Saudi military officer killed 3 American sailors at the naval base in Pensacola. But the jihadi threat has sort of subsided a bit, which doesn't mean that it's going away. And obviously, October 7th and Hamas has, on both sides of the spectrum, made the emotions around that. You know, we saw a 6-year-old Palestinian kid who was murdered by somebody who was enraged by the Gaza war. But it's the right wing. And, you know, there's been right wing terrorism in the United States for a long time. You mentioned William Pierce, who we interviewed after the Oklahoma City bombing. You know, Pierce ran the Nazi Party in the United States. He had a doctorate. He's not a stupid guy. He you mentioned the Turner Diaries. That came out in 76, I think it was first published. And that had J.M. Berger, a terrorism researcher, calculated that something like 200 murders could be ascribed to that book, the influence of that book. Many of them, of course, happened in Oklahoma City, where 168 Americans were killed. So that book was really kind of the Bible for far-right terrorists for years and for decades. And so this issue is not a new one, but it had certainly, we saw January 6th, that more than 1,000 people have been indicted, more than 700 people have been convicted or pled guilty. And that was a pretty large act of domestic terrorism as well.
So what are some of the factors that contribute to this, that domestic extremists pose a greater threat to the United States than Islamic terrorists? How does it differ here than in other parts of the world like Europe?
It's another good question. So, I mean, I think right-wing terrorism in this country, what obviously, like all forms of terrorism, is influenced by social media. You're able to enter a silo and go down a rabbit hole pretty quickly. And there's plenty of material on the internet and like-minded people that you can find very quickly. So I think that obviously has an effect. Here's an interesting kind of question. So to me, it's pretty interesting that the January 6th riot at the Capitol Hill, both of us are not far from where that riot took place, with 1,000 arrests and 700 convictions of various kinds, that's a pretty big demonstration effect. And since then, groups like the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, the 3%ers, et cetera, you know, those organizations, many of their leaders, some of them are serving more than 20-year sentences or have been sentenced to more than 20 years. So I think that has had some effect, because when you look at when former President Trump has been indicted, since then, people have shown up at the courthouse, but there hasn't been some massive demonstration or anything on the scale of January 6th. So I do think that has interrupted these formal groups. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't plenty of lone actors out there, motivated not just by right-wing, far-right ideas, but also it could be jihadi ideas, it could be the incel ideas I just mentioned, or it could be, you know, pick your political ideology. It just happens that the right wing is the most virulent right now.
Something that worries me a lot as an American Jew is the rise in anti-Semitism all over the world, and we're seeing it here in the United States. Do you think that some of that is going to contribute to terror attacks, to more mayhem in the United States?
I do. And I mean, I was, what's interesting to me is about 3 or 4 days ago, three Palestinian terrorists were arrested in Italy. They were allegedly planning to attack Jewish targets. And we also had the arrests of people associated with Hamas in Denmark and Germany a few months back. And all this in the context of post-October 7th. I don't think Hamas has infrastructure in the United States to carry out a terrorist attack, but it seems that they may have it in Europe. I think the rise in anti-Semitism, both in the United States and also in other countries, is likely to contribute to additional violent acts. We saw the Tree of Life attack in Pittsburgh. I mean, there are plenty of anti-Semitic people out there who might be willing to conduct violence. And then, of course, you know, the coming election is going to be very polarizing. And so, I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but the environment right now is pretty conducive to people carrying out violent acts. And of course, we also had, I mentioned the Palestinian boy who was killed by somebody who was enraged by the war in Gaza. We also had the Palestinian students who were shot at, the three of them. So it's not just sort of anti-Semitism, it's also Islamophobic attacks that one has to be concerned about as well.
If you're looking at the right-wing groups right now, you mentioned maybe they've been warned through the January 6th convictions and arrests, but when you're studying these groups now, what do you expect from them in this next year when things in the world are so volatile, when our election is going to be so contentious? What do you expect from these groups?
Well, I do think these groups, they took a huge hit because of January 6th. I mean, a number of them were convicted for seditious conspiracy, which is a very hard charge to convict somebody on. In fact, going back some period of time, the leaders of right-wing groups were acquitted on charges of seditious conspiracy if you go back several decades. And that's also a very rare charge for the Justice Department to bring forward. So the fact that the leaders of these groups have got 20-plus year sentences, I think, has really disrupted those groups. And that's important because, obviously, groups have more ability to do... I mean, there were a lot of people who came on January 6th who weren't affiliated with a group, but the groups, you know, who were the people that were wearing all the tactical gear and had a plan? I mean, these were groups. So the fact that those groups have been disrupted pretty severely, in my view, is a good thing. But it's a double-edged sword, because also groups are easier for law enforcement to penetrate, because there's more people who are talking, there's an organization. What is very hard for law enforcement to penetrate is one person's mind. And the lone actor, whether they're Omar Mateen, who was inspired by ISIS and killed 49 people in Orlando because of stuff, you know, at one point he was sort of self-affiliating with Al-Qaeda, with Hezbollah, and then with ISIS. I mean, he was sort of shopping for an ideology that would justify his violence. And he'd also been to come to the attention of the FBI because he talked about it to people he worked with. Unfortunately, he was able to get through. And it is hard for the FBI and local law enforcement to get inside people's heads. And I mean, and obviously having radical views in the United States is not a crime. And there are probably millions of people with radical views of one kind or another. The question is, how far down the pathway to violence they go, and what is that pathway? That pathway is very predictable, by the way. There's a whole relatively new discipline of threat management, which I first became acquainted with when I went to the behavioral unit at Quantico for my podcast and also previously for a book I'd written. And it was really an eye-opening experience because you may recall this. The New York Police Department in 2007 published this study that had some strengths, which was about how and why people radicalize. It came in for quite a lot of criticism because it also seemed to be partly about people who were becoming more religiously observant. But what opened my eyes about going to Quantico was the FBI doesn't really concern itself with your ideology. They concern themselves with your actions. And that's a much more useful way of looking at all this. Because as I mentioned, Omar Mateen, who was shopping around for an ideology, Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda, like, you know, they're quite different. And the actions, anybody who's carrying out a premeditated act of murder kind of does or goes through a sequence of events, whether it's terrorism or whether it's just somebody who's killing their neighbor because they hate them or something. And that there are six stages in this pathway to violence: ideation, which is kind of the idea. Well, actually, first stage is grievance. Most people have, we all have grievances. Most of us just get over them. These people can't get rid of that grievance, which might be affiliating with a group that they feel is under attack. Let's say it's the white people, or let's say it's Muslims, or whatever they feel. The next stage is ideation, which is they're going to use violence in some way to avenge this grievance. And then there's preparation, thinking about what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. There's often a rehearsal of what you're going to do. And then there's also something called breach, which is a lot of people will do a practice run on the target and see if there's sort of the target's protected, and then finally the attack. And so what law enforcement needs to do, irrespective of the ideology or the motivation, is to see how far down that pathway to violence somebody is. Most of us have inhibitors. An inhibitor would be a job, a marriage, kids, etc. But let's say your inhibitors are sort of falling like dominoes, and suddenly you lose your job, and then your marriage blows up, and you know that person may be like more susceptible to doing something, and maybe you have a history of domestic violence, which I think is an often overlooked issue here, which I think is domestic abuse, domestic violence. I think is a very rich subject for researchers to look at. Because someone like Omar Mateen, who I mentioned earlier, he attacked his first wife and I think his second wife as well, or abused them both. So for law enforcement, the key is having a sense of when to intervene. You don't want to intervene too early because, you know, having radical views is not a crime. But let me just one, there's one other kind of factor here which is important. So the FBI looked at 80 terrorism cases in around 2015. And what they found is really fascinating, and it's related to school shootings. So in school shootings, the school shooter, first of all, is always usually obsessed by Columbine. But secondly, he, and it's almost invariably a he, tends to tell people that he's going to do something. It may not be precisely what he's going to do, but he's going to, you know, the versions of they're going to be sorry, or I'm going to, you know. And they tend to tell that to peers. So peers have the most information and they're the least likely to come forward with information to law enforcement. And so the FBI said, well, let's look at terrorism cases and see if it's the same. And they found out the same. So in law enforcement parlance, a bystander is somebody who knows that something's up. And there are four forms of bystanders. There's a peer, there's family members, there's authority figures like teachers and clerics and that kind of thing, and finally, there's strangers. Now, strangers are the most likely to come forward, but they have the least useful amount of the... So the whole see something, say something campaign is a little bit based on a false view, because strangers may see something that they think is suspicious, but it turns out to be nothing. So this has, I think, very important, whether it's right-wing terrorism or any other form of political violence. The fact is that peers have the most useful information. They may well know that somebody is planning something. Family members often know a little bit, not quite as much as peers. They are slightly more likely to come forward. They are more likely to come forward than peers. And so this allows law enforcement to sort of, instead of having a, we need to boil the ocean, and the discipline of threat management, I think, allows law enforcement to think more carefully and tactically about who is potentially going to be a problem. Because for every, there are hundreds of thousands of people who are looking at all sorts of violent, hateful stuff on the internet and in any given day, and probably 98% of them are never going to do anything about it. But finding the 2%, it's very also, of course, it's super easy to do the analysis after the fact. What is harder, and of course, it's also hard to prove negative. So if you do intervene with somebody who's going down this pathway to violence, and the FBI behavioral unit advises law enforcement around the country on this issue, an attack that doesn't happen is hard to measure. But there is, we have learned, unfortunately, quite a lot, because there's been so much violence of one form or another in this country, whether it's school shootings, whether it's terrorism, whether it's just plain old violence. There are things that we've learned that are useful for law enforcement to know.
So speaking of that, I want to go back to the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. You mentioned their leaders, Stuart Rhodes, sentenced to over 20 years, Enrique Tarrio, Proud Boys, sentenced to, I believe, over 20 years. What has happened to these groups since then?
Well, my impression is, I mean, I'm not an expert in these groups. My impression is that this has been a real blow to them. And, I think that there's an analogy here to Oklahoma City, which was, of course, the most lethal act of terrorism in the United States before 9/11. Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols together killed 168 people. There was a lot of law enforcement pressure on the militia movement, which Nichols and Timothy McVeigh were, they weren't members of the Michigan militia, but they were sort of hanging out on the fringes of these militias. And so, I think the militia movement took a real big blow after Oklahoma City, A, because they got a lot more law enforcement attention, and B, because when you kill 168 people at the federal building in Oklahoma City, and quite a number of children because it was a daycare center in the building, I think it completely undercut that whole view that the government was the enemy and the militia movement were somehow heroes. It didn't last forever, but it had I think, important sort of effect to undercut the claims of the militia movement and people like McVeigh. So I think January 6th was, I can't prove this, but I go back to the fact that when Trump was indicted in like three different jurisdictions, maybe 200 or 300 people showed up to protest. They didn't do anything violent. There weren't any arrests. Now, the 2024 election, there's going to be a lot of anger around whatever the outcome is on either side. And there could well be political violence associated with that. But I'm fairly confident it's going to be lone actors doing their thing. It's not going to be, these groups have suffered a pretty big blow. And not just their leaders, I mean, their foot soldiers and anybody who was identifiable on January 6th, I mean, 1,000 plus arrests, it's a large number of people.
So you're worried on both sides of the spectrum, left and right, what could happen in the 2024 election, even if it's lone actors?
Yeah, well, so if we go back to the 70s, what would the political violence that we would be discussing in this conversation would have been the Weather Underground, maybe the Black Panthers, although they weren't carrying out the same acts as the Weather Underground. There were also Puerto Rican nationalists. who were doing bombings, and people have sort of forgotten about that. So political violence in the United States is like, it's just part of the, I mean, the country was founded in a revolution and forged in a civil war, and you know, it's part of the American story. So leftist violence, leftist political violence in the last several decades has really subsided. That doesn't mean it can't come back in the right set of circumstances, and because we've seen it before. Right-wing political violence has also been with us, and right now we're seeing a fair amount of it. So I am less concerned, based on what we see right now, that it will be left-wing political violence, because we're just not seeing it in quite the same way. But that can change, because history tends to surprise us, and you know, I'm not predicting a large scale left wing political violence in the 2024 election, but I'm not saying it's impossible, because you know it has existed in the past in American political life, and in the right set of circumstances it could come back.
You know, Peter, something that I study pretty closely and teach at my class at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School is media polarization. What role do media outlets play in contributing to the spread of extremist ideologies, both on both sides, right and left?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to take a very narrow slice of that question, because I think I notice, and you know, I work at CNN, we are very careful now to not name the perpetrator of a terrorist attack, a school shooting. There's been, I think, Anderson Cooper has sort of led the way on this at CNN. I think there's been a self-conscious effort to not give airtime to the people who are carrying out these kinds of terrible attacks. Obviously, if somebody's arraigned, you're going to have to name them, because the arraignment happens and they're named in the arraignment. But I think that has been a change. So that's, I think, one way in which the media can actually be responsible. And of course, everybody works in the American media as U.S. citizens, and you know, they don't want to contribute to anything that would lead to violence. You know, I mean, the media is kind of a very vague term, as you know. If we include in media social media, I think you can go down the biggest rabbit hole in history in 24 hours today.
No kidding.
And that's got nothing to do with the so-called mainstream media or the traditional media. I mean, that's the way that it's just the way it is. Now, I think social media companies, you know, they have a hard problem, which is being on a social media platform is not a right. These are private property, essentially. You don't have a right to be on Facebook. You don't have a right to be on Twitter. While Twitter has you know, fallen backwards, a lot of these social media companies have thousands of people who try and bring down content that might incite violence. But the amount of material that exists is just, it's so big, which is not to excuse any of the social media companies. But I'm not convinced that traditional media in some way is stirring things up that's going to lead to violence. What is much more likely is somebody who is interested in violence can quickly find like-minded people anywhere he or she chooses to look. They're going to do that on social media more, I think, than watching CNN or reading the New York Times.
Right. They're self-selecting what information they want to hear in the voice they want to hear it with, the spin they want to hear it on, and then using it to justify their thoughts and their actions.
Yeah.
So given this landscape, what do you think is the effectiveness of current counterterrorism measures against domestic extremism? And what would you recommend, as an expert in this, that current policymakers and law enforcement agencies do in addressing this threat?
Well, I think the counterterrorism measures in this country are quite effective. If you think about September 10th, 2001, and what we have today, people on the left would say they're in some ways overly intrusive. There's Section 702, which allows U.S. government to look at U.S., you know, Americans' communications if they're suspected to be communicating with some outside criminal or terrorist organization. The FBI, I think, does a there's a pretty aggressive effort. You mentioned the right-wing terrorism show that we did relatively recently on In the Room. We interviewed Daryl Johnson, who in 2009 wrote a very prescient report sort of warning about the rise of right-wing extremism. It caused so much consternation at the time that it was actually officially withdrawn by the Obama administration. That would be unimaginable now. I mean, because no one would disagree that domestic terrorism is an issue. At the time, it was regarded as controversial. So, you know, what the government is doing, generally speaking, you know, we have a very big counterterrorism apparatus. I'll just run you through what's happened since 9/11. So first of all, we have the National Counterterrorism Center, which is part of the intelligence community, so it's not involved in domestic law enforcement. But since a lot of this, the distinction between what's domestic and what's international has really sort of collapsed, because if you're radicalizing as a right wing, you're reading Breivik's manifesto from Norway or Brendan Tarrant, who carried out the Christchurch attack, killing 51 people in a mosque in New Zealand. And so we have the National Counterterrorism Center that did not exist, obviously, before 9/11. We have TSA that obviously didn't exist before 9/11. We have DHS, which is the second biggest government department after the Pentagon, that didn't exist before 9/11. We had about 30 joint terrorism task forces before 9/11. Now there are more than 100. The intelligence budget for the U.S. intelligence community has sort of quadrupled since 9/11. And just I could go on and on. And then also, there's also just public knowledge. I mean, there's a kind of just general understanding that terrorism is an issue, which, you know, that goes in waves because it's dependent on events. And obviously, since 9/11, there was a lot of concern about terrorism. That's probably subsided because there has been less terrorism. But I think that the government is doing a pretty good job, you know, given the fact that we have a First Amendment in this country and that holding radical views, Holocaust denial in Germany is illegal. Inciting racial hatred in England, in the UK, is illegal. Neither of those are crimes in the United States. And for good reason, in the sense that the First Amendment is the First Amendment, not the 22nd Amendment. So there are constraints around the First Amendment. Oh, here, this is a very interesting point that I want to make. So we do not have a domestic terrorism federal statute, and that could be helpful. You ask, like, what are the policy? Judges have terrorism enhancements that they can add to a sentence, I think at their own discretion. But we don't have a federal domestic terrorism statute. So, for instance, if you were providing your material support to ISIS, let's say you were sending them money or you were planning to join them or did join them, the sentence you would get would be like 15 to 20 years probably, because ISIS is a foreign terrorist organization. Now, the 3%ers, the Oath Keepers, the Ku Klux Klan, pick your neo-Nazi group in the United States, they are not designated as foreign terrorist organizations. They couldn't be, because they aren't. And they can't be designated as terrorist organizations because they are, it's illegal for me to donate my time or money to ISIS. It's not illegal for me to donate my time or money to a far-right organization, providing I don't do anything, commit a crime. So, and that there's good reasons for that. But if there was a domestic terrorism statute on a federal level, it would allow judges to sentence people for longer. And it would actually kind of, Bruce Hoffman and Jacob Ware, I'm sure you know, at Council on Foreign Relations have recently written a book. In fact, it was in our podcast about far-right terrorism. It's one of the recommendations they make. This law would have to be skillfully written in such a way that it didn't get into things that are protected by the First Amendment. But it would allow, right now, if you're sentenced for a jihadist terrorism crime, you're going to get a longer sentence than if you're sentenced, generally speaking, for some sort of far-right terrorism crime, because there isn't this, at the federal level, a domestic terrorism statute. So that is something that you could imagine would be useful.
Absolutely. Peter, thank you so much for your insight today and for your time. Peter's podcast is called In the Room with Peter Bergen. And thank you so much. We'll be seeing you on CNN and listening to your podcast.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much for this and look forward to it.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts from Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, AIDS 2020, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog.